I'm Jill Anderson. This is the Harvard EdCast. Melinda Manjin wants all schools to be inclusive environments for trans students. She knows this isn't easy work for educators. Today's climate for trans youth can be toxic as states wage legislative battles, parents push back against students' gender identity, and educators are getting fired for supporting students. It's not surprising that many trans students don't feel safe in school, or that schools are afraid to take action on the issue. Melinda has studied schools creating inclusive environments for trans students. I wondered what those schools look like. First, I asked why we need gender-inclusive schools.
We want all our kids to be able to go to school and just be themselves and enjoy school and have a good day. I mean, when you talk to parents, they just want their kids to be happy, right? And we know that gender is not a binary. So when schools are places where we don't recognize the diversity of genders that our kids bring, they become places where our kids aren't affirmed. And so we want kids to be able to explore who they are, explore learning. Gender is a journey. It's a learning journey to figure out who you are. And so we want schools to be inclusive of that journey for all of our kids.
It seems like this has been challenging. I mean, I would say probably a lot of inclusive practices, even beyond, you know, trans children, has been challenging for schools and school climates. What do you think is the biggest hurdle facing educators in making schools more gender inclusive?
I think at one level, there's a lack of understanding, you know, just kind of factual knowledge about what it is to be a transgender person or to understanding gender as a journey. So I think knowledge is one facet of it. When I'm talking to educators, a lot of times there's a fear of doing it wrong. And so that's a kind of hurdle. And then having information about what it actually looks like to be an inclusive school for gender expansive children. What would I have to do as an educator to do that? So, you know, it's kind of a range of levels of knowledge and practice.
So you've been in a lot of schools and done a lot of research in this area about successful practices. What would you say are three examples of inclusive practices that all schools should be doing?
I've made a very intentional effort to go to places that are trying to do this work and doing it not always perfectly, but really with a good faith effort. And when I'm talking to educators, they really describe three kinds of practices. Mm-hmm. One is to stop using binary gender, boy and girl, as kind of categories that will help them organize the day. So when you think about teachers, often, you know, you might line up boys and girls, or you might have partners that are boys and girls, or you might have boy and girl bathroom passes. And so one way that teachers can be more inclusive is to move away from using gender as an organizational tool. And most teachers find that fairly easy to do. There's mm-hmm. lots of other pedagogical strategies for organizing your day and organizing kids that can use other tools. That's one way to stop using binary gender. And then at the same time, teachers have shared that they're also trying to create more opportunities to talk about gender in the classroom. So whether this be through literature or casual conversation as it comes up, not to shy away from the topic of gender, but to embrace it and to point out the wonderful gender diversity that we have in the world. And so at the same time that they're minimizing binary gender, they're attending to more gender diverse kinds of exemplars. So those two things create a more inclusive classroom. And then the third thing that teachers describe doing is just simply affirming children when they say, this is who I am. Just saying, nice to meet you. And I see you and I'm happy to have you in my classroom. And I think kind of reducing the level of policing or surveillance that we traditionally might see in classrooms. And when I say surveillance, I know that sounds very heavy-handed, but I'm thinking about the kinds of practices like maybe a teacher's distributing supplies and, you know, boys get blue supplies and girls get pink supplies, or gently correcting someone like, oh, you know, I don't think that boy would be doing ballet, or correcting a girl like, wouldn't you like something a little bit more gentle? So really conforming to stereotypes is the kind of policing or surveillance that I'm talking about. And so really just affirming children, however they show up, is another really pretty easy way that teachers can create an inclusive classroom.
I know it sounds so easy when you describe it, but in my mind, I'm imagining how hard that can be for a lot of educators, just having the restraint to kind of edit themselves and how they just talk to students.
When I spoke with teachers, when I did interviews with teachers, many of them could remember specific instances. And I think their ability to remember them speak to your point that it sounds easy, but it actually takes intentionality. But I think once you get used to making that part of your routine. So the examples teachers might give me would, you know, if a boy came in with nail polish, just saying, oh, I like your nail polish and leaving it at that. Or, you know, if a girl wanted to play football on the playground, that looks like fun. I like to be active too. So those kinds of just affirming statements that we give all the time.
Is this something educators are learning about in their training?
Teacher training is demanding and it covers a lot, right? There's content knowledge, there's pedagogical knowledge, there's students with special needs, et cetera. And oftentimes a curriculum might have one course dedicated to what you might call diversity, right? Mm. And diversity can be so many things, whether it's neurodiversity or racial ethnic diversity, right? Gender diversity is just one part of it. So I have an opportunity to look at teacher education curriculum. And usually there's a few lessons there related to gender. A lot of the traditional gender training used to be, make sure you call on girls as often as you call on boys. That used to be what we thought of as gender inclusivity, making sure girls got fair opportunities, which obviously is really important. We don't want to stop doing that, but we also want to think beyond boys and girls. And so I think teachers don't always have the opportunities they'd like. And when I speak with educators, they're often hungry for more information and looking for a way to create more affirming educational spaces.
One of the things I imagine happens in a school community, maybe there might be one or two students who are identifying as trans, and then that kind of becomes not the poster child, but I'm going to use that term. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of not just focusing on one student's needs, but also focusing on changing the school culture?
Unfortunately, a lot of times schools don't understand that there is a need to change the culture until there is a child who chooses or, you know, has to disclose their gender identity. So a lot of the schools that I have visited do have one or two students who have disclosed their gender identity, and those children become the impetus for changing practices. But usually what those educators find out very quickly is that those aren't the only two children, that there are other children who are either gender nonconforming or who have even socially transitioned and not disclosed. When I'm talking to parents, it's increasingly common for parents, if their children do socially transition, if they're able to, they often move their children to a new school, you know, if they're have the financial means to even change districts. So it is pretty common for kids to enroll and not share that, you know, they were assigned a different sex at birth. One of the things I try to communicate to educators is you just don't know, and you should assume. Statistically, we're talking about just under 2% of people who identify as transgender. But the Williams Institute did a large study, a large quantitative study, where 27% of the respondents said they were gender nonconforming in some way. Mm. Now, that's a very kind of expansive definition. But if you imagine a quarter of your students somehow see themselves as gender nonconforming, they like something that's not stereotypically appropriate for their assigned gender, you know, then we're talking about a lot of kids. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us to move away from seeing gender as a problem and waiting to fix a problem and trying to reframe it as this is an opportunity to be more expansive in how we understand a concept and to create space for that expansiveness to present itself and really just shifting our mindset about the work that we're doing. We're not fixing a problem, we're creating opportunities for genuine authenticity for kids.
Right. So it sounds like even if you're working in a school and this has not become something that there is either a student who identifies, you should still be changing some of your practices just to create a different environment.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're somebody who really follows numbers, at minimum, 2% of your population is going to somehow identify within the trans umbrella. So, you know, most schools have a sizable enough population. There's somebody, right? There's somebody there within their student body. But also to think beyond the students that we have in our classrooms, these students have families, they have siblings, they have relatives. You know, most people know somebody who identifies as trans. So that's a really rapidly changing way to think about this topic. It isn't just, do I have a trans person in my classroom or in my school, but do we have genderqueer families that we need to be thinking about?
Can you talk a little bit about how practices might need to change, or if they need to change, as students grow from elementary into their middle and high school years?
In the elementary years, where most of my research is, children who transition are socially transitioning. So they're really just changing their clothes or changing their hairstyle, maybe names and pronouns. Those are all things that are not, they're not permanent, right? Mm-hmm. They can change. So it's a little less scary. Once you get to puberty, I think the whole idea of a gendered transition feels scary to people. Mm-hmm. And so middle school and high school feels more consequential. And I don't want to say that they're not. I think that for parents who have a child at home who is questioning their gender identity, I think it is a big issue. It takes up a lot of mental space, right? To figure out, what is this? What's going on? How do I support this journey? But I guess one of the things that I think about a lot is, you know, gender is a journey for all of us. The way I express my gender as a middle-aged woman is different than how I express my gender in other decades of my life. I'm a cisgender woman and I have a gender journey, and transgender people also have a gender journey. Lots of times I hear from educators at the middle school in particular, who will just throw up their hands and say, everybody is something, right? They're all LGBTQ, they're all pan or ace, or teachers are overwhelmed. That's understandable. But we already knew that our prepubescent preteens are dynamic individuals. And, you know, this is one part of that dynamic journey toward adulthood that they're on. And so I think trying to shut it down and is probably not the right path. I think we need more conversations. We have a lot more expertise now related to transition, social transition, medical transition. And I think we just need to know more so that we feel a little bit less scared.
You know, there's a lot of just dismissing that it's just a phase, or it's this or that. So I do wonder about the middle school and high school years, which are really about exploration and how educators can just continue affirming whether someone fully transitions or not, seems to be what you're saying.
Yeah, phase is often used to be dismissive, right? And I think it's helpful to take back that idea of a phase. And yeah, we go through phases. You know, we crawl before we walk, right? Phases are a natural part of life. And some people will be on an exploration phase and move in one direction and then move in another direction. And that's okay. And some people will continue moving in one direction and never look back. And we just don't know. I think that gets back to the kind of affirming the people that we come in contact with without really knowing what their trajectory will be. But especially with children, if we don't affirm that journey, that exploration, I mean, that is learning. Why we go to school is to learn about ourselves and the world around us.
You mentioned fear earlier as being a real issue for educators, and I think we're seeing that play out quite a bit around the country in some places. There's been some lawsuits and challenges being brought against educators who seem like they are trying to just affirm their students. What is your advice to those educators who might be afraid of taking on this work in practice?
Yeah, I think that that's a legitimate fear. I've talked to educators who have been told they can't have a rainbow flag in their classroom. Having your career threatened puts you in a very vulnerable place. So I would never want to downplay that. And there are certainly states where, you know, it has become illegal to affirm a child's gender, their chosen gender identity. So it's incredibly challenging for teachers to be able to do this work in those contexts. And, you know, I'm not sure it's fair to say, well, you know, try to sneak it in. But I would say that kids know who is supportive. They know who is open, who's a safe person. And so I think for teachers to try to model in any way that they can without putting themselves at risk. I mean, ideally, I'd like to say, yeah, everybody should be a gender warrior and put your career at risk because children's lives are at stake. I mean, that's real. children's lives are at stake because the attempted suicide rates are very high for trans and gender nonconforming children. So, you know, is a career more important than a child's life? Obviously not. But at the same time, I think it becomes incredibly difficult when you are in an environment where the facts around gender are shut down.
The principal can have a huge impact on this. Can you talk about how a principal can shape the way this plays out in schools?
Yeah, I mean, principals are in a position of a lot of authority. Oftentimes, principals feel responsible for being highly competent, right? Knowing everything, doing everything, having their finger on the pulse of everything that goes on. When I spoke with principals who were trying to do this work in meaningful ways, many of them were very quick to say they were learners. They understood that there was more going on that they had learned about in school, or maybe that they understood from their own, you know, personal gender journey didn't map onto what they were learning about. So first and foremost, you know, when principals are willing to step up and become learners around the topic of gender diversity, I think that sets an incredible role model for teachers to be able to do that kind of work. Really interestingly, a lot of the kind of, and I'll call it actually fear mongering, a lot of the conversation is about, well, what if I did that? What if I had a rainbow flag? And then, you know, next thing I know, the news media knows, and then there's protests, and, you know, there's this vision of a huge snowball effect or reprisals and backlash. There's a lot of rhetoric around that. When I talked to teachers before going to visit schools, this was the fear. And then, you know, I visited 20 different schools in 6 states, and the principals shared, they said, yeah, we were worried about reprisals. We were worried about angry parents. We were worried about the media. And I said, it hasn't played out. They could mention, you know, a couple of parents who had called and said, what's going on over there? And when they explained it, it was like, oh, okay, thanks for letting us know. But really, at least in the context where I was able to visit, there wasn't a huge backlash. And principals were able to really create a learning environment for their teachers and for themselves so that they could provide a more affirming environment.
What should parents be going to their schools asking for and looking for and expecting from educators on this?
As you said, anytime you show up at school with an ask for educators, they're always a little bit worried about, is your ask appropriate, right? Are you second guessing them as educators, as experts? What I've found is when parents show up about gender as the topic, educators are usually pretty willing to say, we're not the experts here. Help us understand this. Help us learn what we need to do. You know, teachers want to support their children, their students in the classroom. They want their students to love coming to school, to be happy and well-adjusted. So I think when parents bring this topic to the attention of school officials and say, hey, look, this is going on at home, or this is, you know, what my child's expressing, you know, educators are usually willing to listen. How to move forward is a conversation, right? And one of the things I learned is that there's no one right way to move forward, right? What one child needs to feel supported might not be the same thing as what another child needs to be supported. So it isn't like, oh, well, we have, you know, one trans child and this is what they got, so that's what your child's going to get as well. It's really much more of a subtle, ongoing conversation because needs are going to change over time as well. So I think it's really about the partnership. And I think parents are usually scared that the educators aren't going to hear them or understand the importance of gender diversity. And I think lots of times they're surprised. The educators have just been waiting for the parents to step forward so that they can partner around the topic and create a pathway forward.
I just want to flip the script a little bit and imagine that if you're a principal and the parent is coming to your office, or you're the teacher and that parent is reaching out to you, what should your response be?
Well, first and foremost, to really listen, right? Because for most families, if your child is expressing some type of gender curiosity, it can be confusing. And parents might not know exactly what they're asking for, right? So I think that first of all, the principal does need to be just really listening to what that family is sharing, because it's personal and it might feel very consequential. But principals should be aware of what the law says and what the policy in their district and state. You know, I mentioned already that I'm in New Jersey, where we have very strong policies in favor of affirming children's gender identity. That's not all situations, but sometimes a school district has its own policy in place. And so having that kind of knowledge can be helpful. Ideally, principals would have some basic vocabulary related to gender. You know, that's not always the case. And then I think it's just a matter of being open and saying, look, I'm learning, I'm willing to learn, and help me understand what kinds of supports we need to put in place.
Melinda Manjin is a professor in the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University. She is the author of Transgender Students in Elementary School, Creating an Affirming and Inclusive School Culture, and co-editor of Trans Studies in K-12 Education, Creating an Agenda for Research and Practice. I'm Jill Anderson. This is the Harvard EdCast, produced by the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Thanks for listening.